ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls, the chocolate room.
Actor and writer Gene Wilder, who brought his signature manic energy to films such as The Producers, Blazing Saddles, Young Frankenstein, and the role that forever ensconced him in the collective memory of a generation of children, Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory, has died. He was 83. Wilder died early Monday at his home in Stamford, Connecticut, of complications from Alzheimer's disease. In the first of his three pairings with director Mel Brooks, 1967's The Producers, Wilder endeared himself to audiences as the anxious accountant Leo Bloom, a nebbish drawn into an elaborate scheme to create a surefire theatrical flop.
You can't hold yourself! Don't touch me! Don't touch me! Oh, my God, no, no.
Wilder's performance in The Producers received a supporting actor Oscar nod. He went on to team up with Mel Brooks again in the classic Blazing Saddles, where he played a washed-up gunslinger, the Waco Kid.
A man drink like that and he don't eat, he is going to die.
When?
What's your name?
Well, my name is Jim. But most people call me Jim.
And then there was Young Frankenstein, the 1974 film in which he played the grandson of the infamous Victor Frankenstein with Marty Feldman and Terry Garr.
Now, that brain that you gave me, was it Hans Delbrooks? No. Ah. Good. Would you mind telling me whose brain I did put in?
And you won't be angry?
I will not be angry.
Abby someone.
Abby who?
Abby Normal.
Abby Normal.
I'm almost sure that was the name.
Are you saying that I put an abnormal brain into a 7.5 foot long, 54 inch wide gorilla?
What?
Is that what you're telling me?
In 2005, Gene Wilder published a memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger. I spoke with him at length about his childhood, his career, and those he worked with. The book came after he had pretty much stopped making films, and he wanted to return to writing.
I was asked to write a book maybe 3 or 4 times over the last 15 years, and I always said, I'd like to, but I'm not ready yet. And 2 years ago, someone very close to me was very ill and had to have a big operation. So instead of coming back from California after 1 week, I stayed for 2 months. And I started writing down on a yellow legal pad and a blue felt pen all the ironies in my life that changed the course of my life. And after a short while, I said, here's the structure for a book that I've been looking for. Because so many accidents happened to me that caused marriage or where I lived, which movie I did. I know we all have these kinds of accidents, but that's the impulse I had, the impetus to start writing it. And then once I started writing it, all flowed out.
It's such a personal book and very honest. Does that become more freeing and easier, in a sense?
Than the opposite?
Yes.
Yes, it is. It's easier to tell the truth. The only time I held back, I didn't ever lie, but the only time I held back was when I didn't want to hurt. So I didn't tell maybe every single detail. Mm. But it's easier to tell the truth. And by telling the truth, more doors opened in the areas that I was writing about. So it was good.
Tell us about the title.
Well, 3 weeks before she died, Gilda came up to me in our living room, and she said, "I have a title for you. Kiss Me Like a Stranger. Maybe you can use it someday." And I hadn't a clue what she was talking about or what the title meant. I just said, "Thanks, honey," and let it go at that. And 14 years later, I was writing this book. I had a different title. I had called it I Lean Towards Women, which is, I realized later, a stupid title because it sounds like it's the story of a man who's got one leg shorter than the other. But as I was writing, especially when I got to the parts about Gilda and what suffering she was going through and the troubles I had, her title came to mean something special to me. And then when I met, after she died, when I met Karen, who I've been married to now for 13 and a half years, another meaning for Kiss Me Like a Stranger came to mind. And I said, "Well, Gilda, I don't know if this is what you had in mind. Now I want to use that title."
You write in the book about your childhood and about your mother who was quite ill, and you tell the story about when you were eight and a doctor was visiting and stopped on his way out and said to you, "Don't ever argue with your mother, you might kill her," and then added, "Try to make her laugh." How would you do that? How would you try to make her laugh?
I was doing Danny Kaye routines because I had never seen him in a movie because he hadn't made a movie yet, but someone gave me an album of songs that he sang that his wife, Sylvia Fine, had written. I used to love to imitate those songs, and I did those. And then later on, I would do German accents and Yiddish accents and any comedian who was on the radio or on television later when it came about, I would try to imitate, and I would make my mother laugh a lot. And when I was very successful, she would pee in her pants and say, "Oh, Jerry," because that was my name then, "now look what you've made me do," and she'd run to the bathroom. And, you know, when the mother gives you confidence that you're good at something, it carries over. And I thought, well, I can make other people laugh too. But in those days, I was thinking more only about comedy and maybe being a comedian. But when I saw, when I was 16, I did summer theater, summer stock, for the first time. And afterwards, I went to New York with my sister, and we saw Lee J. Cobb in Death of a Salesman. And after seeing that, I said, "I don't want to be a comedian. I want to be an actor. Maybe a comic actor, but an actor."
What was your mother's reaction to that desire to act?
She was all for it because she thought I was good. I was acting in plays and studying acting even in Milwaukee since 13. When I say plays, I mean amateur, with the Milwaukee Community Theater, things like that. But my father said, "Yeah, you go on, you're a natural, but don't put all your eggs in one basket," because he wanted me to take over his business, which was making little miniature beer and whiskey glasses. Which was good for a while when I was a kid, a little kid. But that business dried up later on. He always thought I should not put all my eggs in one basket. And then one day, after he saw Willy Wonka, he said, "I think maybe it's a good thing you put all your eggs in one basket."
Do you think there is such a thing as being a natural? Did you feel very natural up there even those early years?
I did in certain parts. I didn't in other parts. The closest I've come to feeling that I was a natural was in The Producers. because I fit that like a glove. And in Young Frankenstein, those two flowed like honey coming out of my heart. It was fun, and I knew what I was doing. I felt that way to an extent in Willy Wonka, but more in a film I did called The Frisco Kid that I did with Harrison Ford. That was a part that came naturally to me. I don't mean that the others weren't good parts for me, but just that I wouldn't have used the term natural, that I was a natural for it. Silver Streak, Stir Crazy, maybe Stir Crazy, but I worked hard to make them funny, but the producers and Young Frankenstein came just like the bell went off and said, you're meant to play this part.
You were born Jerry Silberman.
Mm-hmm.
When and why did you decide to change your name?
Well, I was finally accepted into the Actors Studio, which was my biggest hope and dream. And I thought, I don't want to be introduced to Elia Kazan and Paul Newman and Shelley Winters and Rod Steiger and all the people I knew would be there as Jerry Silberman. I couldn't see Jerry Silberman in Macbeth, something serious, dramatic. So I thought of Jean came from Thomas Wolfe's Look Homeward, Angel, Eugene Gant, but everyone who loved him called him Jean.
Mm-hmm.
And Wilder came from Thornton Wilder, who wrote my favorite play, still my favorite play, Our Town.
Mm-hmm.
So I put the two together. And then I was introduced as Gene Wilder.
You always have loved the name ever since, I assume.
Yeah, it was the right name for me. Short, simple. It could be a comedy, it could be a drama, it could be anything, and that's what I wanted.
Gene Wilder started taking acting classes at the age of 12. In 1961, he became a member of Lee Strasberg's prestigious Actors Studio in Manhattan. That same year, he made both his off-Broadway and Broadway debuts using the stage name Gene Wilder. He won the Clarence Derwent Award given to promising newcomers for the Broadway work in Graham Greene's comedy, The Complacent Lover. And then a key break came in 1963.
The big break was being terribly miscast in Mother Courage for Broadway, a play by Bertolt Brecht, and Jerome Robbins was directing it. I had auditioned 6 times for it. And I finally got the part and then realized that I was wrong for it. But the star of the play was Anne Bancroft, whose boyfriend at the time was Mel Brooks. And she wanted me to meet Mel because he came to pick her up in her dressing room each night after the show. And I saw him, and he'd seen me act several times. And he said, I've got a screenplay I'm writing. I only have 30 pages, but would you like to come out to Fire Island with Annie and me, and I'll read you the first 30 pages. And that's when he read Springtime for Hitler, which the title was later changed to The Producers. If I hadn't been miscast in that, I wouldn't have met Mel, and I wouldn't have done The Producers, Blazing Saddles, or Young Frankenstein.
What was your initial reaction to those 30 pages of Springtime for Hitler?
I hope I can play this part. And then he asked me if I would like to play the part.
Well, let's see. If we add these, we get 10, 4. Amazing. It's absolutely amazing. But under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit. Yes, it's quite possible. If he were certain that the show would fail, a man could make a fortune.
Yes?
Yes, what?
What you were saying. Keep talking.
What was I saying?
You were saying that under the right circumstances, a producer could make more money with a flop than he could with a hit.
Yes, it's quite possible.
You keep saying that, but you don't tell me how.
I thought, well, he had the money and he's ready to go. But actually, it was 3 years before he found me again. He'd been trying to raise the money for 3 years. And he finally did raise it.
Because your first film was Bonnie and Clyde.
Yeah, that was a wonderful, small part. But it was a wonderful part, and I had a wonderful director in Arthur Penn. Yeah, that's got me started.
So then comes The Producers and working with Mel Brooks and, of course, Zero Mostel. What did you learn from Zero Mostel?
I learned as much, mostly not about acting, but about life. He had been very successful and then was blacklisted and couldn't get arrested, couldn't get a job anywhere. And he was painting, which was his first love, until he finally got a part off Broadway, not on television. They wouldn't allow him on television or movies. And then he got Rhinoceros on Broadway, where he turned into a rhinoceros in front of your eyes. And then a funny thing happened on the way to the Forum, and he was a huge star. And he wasn't afraid of any authority figure after that. And I think that's what impressed me the most.
Not at all a great success when it first came out. Did the afterlife of The Producers surprise you at all?
The Producers was a commercial flop, but it's hard to say what would have happened if Joseph E. Levine, who had Embassy Pictures, who distributed the film, hadn't sold it to television right away when it got a bad review from the New York Times. Because then Mel won the Academy Award, I was nominated for an Academy Award, and then it became a cult film, and then it became a classic. But he sold it right away, so it never really had a chance.
You say in the book that while you liked Roald Dahl's Charlie and the Chocolate Factory, you were not sure you wanted to play Willy Wonka.
I wanted to play Willy Wonka, but it was incomplete. And I said, I like the script. When the director came to my home and said, what do you think? I said, but I want to add something to it on my first entrance. I want to come out with a cane and have everyone think I'm a cripple. And then walk towards the crowd, and they're all quieting down now, and my cane gets stuck in a brick, and I start to fall forward, and then I do a somersault and jump up, and everyone applauds.
Welcome, my friends. Welcome to my chocolate factory.
He said, what do you want to do that for? And I said, because from that time on, no one will know whether I'm lying or telling the truth. And he said, you mean to tell me that you won't do the part unless I put that in? I said, yeah, that's what I'm saying. He said, okay, it's in. And I did mean it from the bottom of my heart that I wouldn't have done it, because the part was good, but you needed to have that mystery about him, that is he lying now or is he telling the truth? And it worked out fine.
I want to talk to you about two of my favorite films of all time, of course, Blazing Saddles and Young Frankenstein, which you mentioned.
Yeah.
You write that much like how this book began on a yellow pad and a felt tip marker,
yeah,
that Young Frankenstein began with you in that legal pad simply writing the words Young Frankenstein.
That's right.
In black and white.
Yes, in black and white.
Why black and white?
Well, I'd seen enough of the Hammer films, and then all the others that they made, all in this terrible color. And I said, it's not believable. And then I looked back at some of the old films, and someone was shot, Jimmy Cagney or whoever, and he's bleeding. And that was terrifying. I did believe it. And the black and white was more believable to me than the color. And since I was writing as a satire of all these old Frankenstein movies, I thought it would be ludicrous to have this new satire done in color when the originals were all in black and white. And so I wrote at the top of the page, in black and white. I didn't know whether it would be accepted or not, but it was. Mel must have fought for it somewhere along the line.
On that page, you wrote two pages of the story, and then that night called Mel Brooks. What was his initial reaction?
He said, it's cute. That's cute. Yeah, I was very discouraged. I thought he'd think it was more than cute. And then I got a call from my then agent, Mike Medavoy, who said, have you got anything for you and Peter Boyle and Marty Feldman? And I said, well, what makes you think of the three of us? He said, because I now handle you and Peter and Marty. And I said, well, that's a wonderful artistic basis for a film. As it happens, I do have something, but he said, let me have it. I said, no, give me a day or two. I want to work on it a little bit more. And then that night, I wrote the Transylvania Station scene almost verbatim the way it is in the film now.
Dr. Frankenstein.
Frankenstein.
You're putting me on.
No, it's pronounced Frankenstein.
Do you also say Frederick?
No, Frederick.
Well, why isn't it Frederick Frankenstein?
It isn't, it's Frederick Frankenstein.
I see.
You must be Igor.
No, it's pronounced Igor.
But they told me it was Igor.
Well, they were wrong then, weren't they?
And I sent it off to him, and he said, I think I can sell this, and maybe we can get Mel Brooks to direct it. I said, I don't think he'll direct something he didn't conceive of. And the next day, Mel called me. He said, what are you getting me into? And I said, nothing you don't want to get into. I don't know, he said, I don't know. And the next day, he agreed to do it. Now, the producers had been a flop, and the next film he did, Blazing Saddles, was a flop, and now they were offering him quite a bit of money to direct Young Frankenstein, and so he agreed to do it. I think if either of those other two films had been a success, I don't think he would have directed Young Frankenstein.
What was he like to work with as a writing partner? And just as a in working with him as a partner, what have you...
Oh, it was wonderful.
What do you want from that relationship?
But you see, he was working on getting ready for Blazing Saddles, and he would just come to me after dinner and look at what I'd written, and he'd say, okay, but now we need a villain, because we don't have a villain. And then I'd say something like, Lionel Atwell, who stuck the darts into his wooden arm. Yeah, that's good. And then he'd go away, and then I would write all day, and he'd look at that, says good. Then we'd go on to the next thing. And he would just say what he thought was missing. And the only scene we actually wrote together was the scene where I take the monster up on the elevator up to the skies where it's lightning out. That long speech as the elevator rising to the skies. That one we wrote together. From this stinking bit of slime, so on. But that's the only one we wrote. Then there were things that he stuck in while we were filming when something extra was needed, like, walk this way. He told Marty, tell Gene, walk this way and bend over when you walk out of the scene after Transylvania Station. And I said, what does that mean? He said, I'll tell you later. So Marty bent over and he said, walk this way. And I bent over and I walked like Marty. And afterwards, the crew was laughing, but I said, it's funny, but what does it mean? And he said, a man has a terrible case of hemorrhoids, and he goes to a druggist, and he says, have you got any talcum powder? And the druggist says, yes, sir, walk this way. And the man says, if I could walk that way, I wouldn't need the talcum powder. And he said, it's an old vaudeville routine. I'd never heard it before. That was wonderful. And the other time, well, he added, what knockers? I didn't write that. It was a wonderful addition when I'm just taking Terry Garr down from the hay wagon, and I'm looking at Marty knocking these huge iron knockers against the giant door.
What knockers?
Oh, thank you, Doctor.
That was an addition we did that night. And then the third time that I remember was... The scene was good, but it wasn't going really well when Madeline first arrives at Transylvania Station. And he says, Marty, when Jean asks you to help me with these bags, you say to Jean,
certainly. You take the blonde and I'll take the one in the Taven.
And we all laughed a lot. And that little bit helped the scenes. Of course, Marty also bit off the tail of Madeline's fox fur, right, and had it stuck in his mouth during the scene. Those kinds of things were added, but otherwise we had done four drafts, so there was no improvising in it.
Putting on the Ritz was your idea?
Yeah. He fought against it.
Really?
Yeah. He read it that night and he said, this is frivolous. You can't just jump into Irving Berlin dancing, you and the monster tap dancing.
If you're blue and you don't know where to go to, why don't you go where fashion sits?
In the reef!
Different types who wear a day coat, pants with stripes, or cutaway coat, perfect fits.
In the reef!
And I started arguing, the only argument we ever had, and ever. And I argued till I was blue, red or blue in the face. And after 20 minutes, he said, okay, it's in. And I said, why did you put me through this? And he said, because I wasn't sure. I knew if you fought for it, it must be right. And if you didn't fight for it, it's wrong. So he put it in.
Wilder was close friends with Richard Pryor, and their contrasting personas, Wilder uptight, Pryor loose, were ideal for comedy. They co-starred in four films, Silver Streak, See No Evil, Hear No Evil, Another You, and of course, Stir Crazy.
Will the defendants rise? Considering all the facts and arguments presented by both counsel, and after careful deliberation, I find the defendants guilty as charged. Do you wish to waive the right to a pre-sentence hearing?
No. Yes, Your Honor.
Taking into account the severe and ruthless nature of this crime and the bleak prospects for your rehabilitation, I hereby sentence you to serve 125 years in the custody of the Commissioner of the Department of Corrections.
What? Wait, no, sit. You know, we didn't do it. There's a misunderstanding.
That's
we didn't do it.
We didn't. I didn't.
Our lawyer told us to come up. He's joking. He means
I
we
told
didn't
him.
Do it.
See,
we didn't do it.
Have you got the right case?
You had a wonderful partnership with Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
You define him in the book as sullen.
Sullen, yes.
Passively resentful, gloomy-tempered, not responding to friendliness or encouragement, melancholy. And you say in the book that if the dictionary had added brilliantly funny, often exhibiting warmth and affection, it could have been defining Richard Pryor.
Mm-hmm.
The partnership worked with you on screen so well. How long did it take you to develop a friendship and a good working relationship?
About 60 seconds on the first scene of the first film, which was Silver Streak. We had met the night before and gave a little handshake, a little hug. But we started working the next morning. There were helicopters and police cars and a lot of extras. And he said a line, and I said a line. Then he said a line that wasn't in the script, and I answered without thinking about what to say. I just answered spontaneously, and then he said another line that was in the script, and I did, and pretty soon I realized that this is the way it's going to be with him, because he improvises all the time. I improvised in class at the Actor's Studio, but not in front of the camera, and he was my teacher in that.
Was there a shift in his, from working with him, was there a difference in working with him on Silver Streak to Stir Crazy?
In Stir Crazy, we got along great. It wasn't that, but he was, I believe, on drugs then. I'm not telling you anything that everyone doesn't know, because
Right. After
a short while it was printed that he set himself on fire freebasing, and it wasn't long after we finished Stir Crazy that happened, and then everything came clear. But when he did get to work, even though he was late for a long while, we hugged and carried on just as we always had. Then on See No Evil, Hear No Evil, everything was peaches and roses. Well, we never had a fight. It wasn't that. It was just that during Stir Crazy, that's when I saw the sullen part. Well, also a little bit when he thought the men's lavatory at the Union Station scene, when he's putting shoe polish on me so I can pass as black with him.
Right.
He didn't want to do it. And I said, didn't you read this scene before? He said, yeah, well, sometimes I have people read it to me. I don't know, but I'm going to hurt a lot of black people. And I said, well, what should it be? What do you want? He said, no, it's too late. And we were going to film it the next morning. And I said, it's not too late. I can call Alan Ladd Jr., the head of 20th Century Fox. I can call the director. But you got to tell me what it is. He said, too late, too late. I said, well, if you change your mind, would you call me? And 15 minutes later, he said, can I come down and see you? I said, of course. And I said, you're going to tell me? He said, yeah. We're in the men's room, and you've got shoe polish on your face, and a white man comes in, and he thinks you're black right away. And I said, what should it be? And he said, it should be a black man who comes in. He's not fooled for a second.
Bill, I'm the king. Number one, baby.
I'm not. Hey, you must be in pretty big trouble, fella. For God's sake, man, to keep clean.
And I said, that's a better scene. And told Arthur Hiller, and he got recast it, and the scene turned out fine. But before that, he put me through the mill because he kept saying, no, there's nothing you can do, and nothing. That's where the sullen part came from.
You say in the book, it's difficult to continue loving someone who does this to you, paraphrasing, but you said you did because of the moments of magic that you shared together.
Yes, that's right. That's right.
And good moments, too.
Yeah, thank you.
How did you meet Gilda Radner?
Sidney Poitier, who was directing this film, it was called Hanky Panky, said, you want to go into New York with me to see Gilda Radner about this other, about the female lead? She's in a play there called Lunch Hour, directed by Mike Nichols. And I said, well, I don't have to go to New York. I think she's wonderful. So he went to New York and saw a matinee performance and took her to dinner. And she said yes. And so on August 13th, 1981, she came to the set, which was outdoor set on the Hudson River, just where the ships, most of the big ships are docking. And we were doing our first night of night shooting. And I met her and we talked and it was very pleasant.
What the hell are you doing in my apartment?
This is Nathan Curry's apartment.
You're a friend of Nathan Curry?
Yes, who are you?
I'm Michael Jordan. He's got my apartment in Chicago. We exchanged apartments.
Oh, I'm Kate Hellman. I'm sorry.
How do you
I mean,
do?
I thought you were a burglar. I thought you
were a burglar. Well, when you opened the door, I almost bashed your brains in.
And she told me later that she cried all the way in from her house in Connecticut because she knew that she was going to fall in love with me and leave her husband, and we were going to get married. I said, no, come on, Gilda. You can't be serious. And she said, no, I am. I knew it. And then she told me how unhappy she was in her marriage. She liked him very much, but there were lots of problems. And she said, I knew I was going to fall in love with you and try and get you to marry me. And it happened. But I always asked her, months later, is that true, that story you told me? So, yes, it is. It's true.
You are so honest and personal about your relationship. Was that difficult to write about?
To write about the happy parts was not difficult. To write about the sad parts was difficult because it was opening up a wound when she was suffering and I was unhappy. But I wanted the readers to understand what was really going on. And I hope now that those who have read the book, that they will know. It wasn't peaches and roses then, when she was stage 4 ovarian cancer. Mm. And she would scream and yell, and I would say, you treat everyone you meet, every stranger on the street, with so much love and courtesy. And with me, you're yelling and screaming all the time. And she said, but you're my husband. Who else can I do it with? And, of course, I understood it.
You write in the book that you never believed that she would die.
No,
of cancer.
I didn't. I was sublimely stupid. Everyone seemed to know it, but not me. I had faith, not religious faith, but I honestly believed medically that she would pull through. Until 3 weeks before she died, and then I realized that the jig was up. she was going to die.
You write and told us a moment ago about marrying Karen, the love of your life, you call her?
Oh, yes.
How did you meet?
I had to do research on See No Evil, Hear No Evil. I was asked to write it for Richard and myself, and there were other versions of it, and they were a wonderful concept, but rotten scripts. They didn't know what they were talking about with the deaf and the blind. And when a TriStar asked me to write it, I said, well, now I've got to do my homework. And I went to the New York League for the Hard of Hearing. Please call a Ms. Webb at the New York League for the Hard of Hearing. And I had my secretary call, and then Ms. Webb called me, and I thought, this is going to be some New England biddy who's going to be, well, you're making fun of the deaf. And the phone rang, and I said, hello, this is Ms. Webb, and this beautiful voice came on the phone, and I said, hi. And she said, I think it's a very funny script, and it'll be wonderful, you and Richard doing it, and so many people seeing it, but, you know, it's filled with errors. And I said, well, that's why I came to you. And so I made an appointment, and she introduced me to beginners, lip reading, intermediate and advanced, and I could ask questions of any of the clients there who had lost their hearing or were losing their hearing, because I was playing someone who had lost his hearing. And she said, if I ever get the grant money to make a video to send out to people all over the country who can't afford to come to New York, would you help me? And I said, sure, I will. And about 3 months later, she called and said, I got the grant money. Can I send you the script? And I said, yes, of course. She sent me the script, and I called her, and I said, this script is going to close on page 4. There's not one laugh in it. And she said, would you meet with me? I said, yeah. We met at a little Italian restaurant. And she brought a tape recorder along, and she had a brilliant idea of dividing it into little comedy sections. And I improvised while we ate. And she said, what would you do if the person you're trying to talk to read their lips, if the person has a big bushy mustache covering his upper lip? And what would you do if the person was chewing gum? What would you do if the person was standing in a shadow and you couldn't see his lips? And I would just improvise, and she recorded it all, and then we'd meet a second time, and we'd do the same thing. And the third time, she said, I think I'd like one more meeting, and I said, this time, leave the recorder at home. And that's when we had our first date.
What's next for you? What would you still like to do?
Well, everyone wants me to write another book, but it's not so easy. I mean, it's not the writing part that's hard. It's deciding what to write, because I really poured my guts out in this book, and I don't want to just go back and do the same thing over unless I can find something that I think would be intriguing for the audience to read. I'm offered scripts all the time, but nothing that I want to do. There are no Blazing Saddles or Young Frankensteins or The Producers coming out. But if one comes along, that would be my fondest wish, would be to do another really good film. But I don't want to do a film just to get another part.
Well, the name of this book, and it is wonderful, it's Kiss Me Like a Stranger. It's published by St. Martin's Press, My Search for Love and Art. What a great pleasure to talk to you.
Thanks, Joe.
We spoke with Gene Wilder in 2005 on the occasion of his memoir, Kiss Me Like a Stranger. He died Monday at the age of 83.
Hold your breath. Make a wish. Count to three.
Come with me and you'll be in a world of pure imagination. Take a look and you'll see into your imagination. We'll begin with a spin, traveling in the world of my creation. What we'll see will defy.
explanation. If you want to view paradise, simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it, want to change the world, there's nothing to it. No life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly wish to be. Simply look around and view it. Anything you want to do it. Want to change the world. There's nothing to it. There is no life I know to compare with pure imagination. Living there, you'll be free if you truly.